the cost-benefit analysis of the options that arise is far from obvious. Being awake is relatively costly compared with lying dormant. Think of its root, dormire. So presumably, Mother Nature economizes where she can. If we could get away with it, we'd sleep our entire lives. That is what trees do, after all. All winter they hibernate in deep coma, because there is nothing else for them to do. And in the summer, they estivate, in a somewhat lighter coma, in what the doctors call a vegetative state when a member of our species has the misfortune to enter it. If the woodchopper comes along while the tree is sleeping, well, that's just the chance that trees have to take, all the time. But surely we animals are at greater risk from predators while we sleep. Not necessarily. Leaving the den is risky, too. And if we're going to minimize that risky phase, we might as well keep the metabolism idling while we bide our time, conserving energy for the main business of replicating. These matters are much more complicated than I am portraying them, of course. My point is just that the cost-benefit analysis is far from obvious, and that is enough to remove the air of paradox. We think that being up and about, having adventures and completing projects, seeing our friends and learning about the world, is the whole point of life. But Mother Nature doesn't see it that way at all. A life of sleep is as good a life as any other, and in many regards better, certainly cheaper than most. If the members of some other species also seem to enjoy their periods of wakefulness as much as we do, this is an interesting commonality. So interesting that we should not make the mistake of assuming it must exist just because we find it to be such an appropriate attitude towards life in our own case. Its existence in other species needs to be shown, and that is not easy. What we are is very much a matter of what culture has made us. Now we must ask how this all got started. What sort of evolutionary revolution happened that set us apart so decisively from all the other products of genetic evolution? The story I am going to tell is a retelling of the story we encountered in Chapter 4 about the creation of the eukaryotic cells that made multicellular life possible. You will recall that before there were cells with nuclei, there were simpler and more solitary life forms, the prokaryotes, destined for nothing fancier than drifting around in an energy-rich soup, reproducing themselves. Not nothing, but not much of a life. Then, one day, according to Lynn Margulis's wonderful story, 1981, some prokaryotes were invaded by parasites of sorts, and this turned out to be a blessing in disguise, for whereas parasites are, by definition, deleterious to the fitness of their hosts, these invaders turned out to be beneficial, and hence were symbionts, but not parasites. They, and those they invaded, became more like commensals, literally from the Latin, organisms that feed at the same table, or mutualists, benefiting from each other's company. They joined forces, creating a revolutionary new kind of entity, a eukaryotic cell. This opened up the vast space of possibilities we know as multicellular life, a space previously unimaginable, to say the least. Prokaryotes are no doubt clueless on all topics. Then a few billion years passed while multicellular life forms explored various nooks and crannies of design space until, one fine day, another invasion began in a single species of multicellular organism, a sort of primate, which had developed a variety of structures and capacities, don't you dare call them pre-adaptations, that just happened to be particularly well-suited for these invaders. It is not surprising that the invaders were well adapted for finding homes in their hosts, since they were themselves created by their hosts, in much the way spiders create webs and birds create nests. In a twinkling, less than 100,000 years, These new invaders transformed the apes, who were their unwitting hosts, into something altogether new. Witting hosts, who, thanks to their huge stock of newfangled invaders, could imagine the heretofore unimaginable, leaping through design space as nothing had ever done before. Following Dawkins, 1976, I call the invaders memes, and the radically new kind of entity created when a particular sort of animal is properly furnished by, or infested with, memes, is what is commonly called a person. That is the story in rough outline. Some people, I have found, just hate the whole idea. They like the idea that it is our human minds and human culture that distinguish us sharply from all the thoughtless brutes, as Descartes called them. But they don't like the idea of trying to give an evolutionary explanation of the creation of this most important distinguishing mark. I think they are making a big mistake. Do they want a miracle? Do they want culture to be God-given? A skyhook, not a crane? Why? They want the human way of life to be radically different from the way of life of all other living things, and so it is. But, like life itself, and every other wonderful thing, culture must have a Darwinian origin. It, too, must grow out of something less, something quasi, something merely as if, rather than intrinsic. And at every step along the way, the results have to be, as David Haig puts it, evolutionarily enforceable. For culture, we need language, for instance. But language has to evolve on its own hook first. We can't just notice how good it would be once it was all in place. We can't presuppose cooperation. We can't presuppose human intelligence. We can't presuppose tradition. This all has to be built up from scratch, just the way the original replicators were. Settling for anything less in the way of an explanation would be just giving up. In the next chapter, I will address the important theoretical questions about how language and the human mind could evolve in the first place by Darwinian mechanisms. I will have to confront and disarm the tremendous and largely misguided animosity to this story, and also work out answers to the responsible objections to it. But before we consider how this magnificent crane structure might have been built, I want to sketch the completed product, distinguishing it from its caricatures, and showing in a little more detail how culture comes to have such revolutionary powers. 2. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Human beings owe their biological supremacy to the possession of a form of inheritance quite unlike that of other animals, exogenetic or exosomatic heredity. In this form of heredity, information is transmitted from one generation to the next through non-genetic channels, by word of mouth, by example, and by other forms of indoctrination. In general, by the entire apparatus of culture. Peter Medawar, 1977, page 14. The nucleic acids invented human beings in order to be able to reproduce themselves, even on the moon. Saul Spiegelman, quoted in Eigen, 1992, page 124. I am convinced that comparisons between biological evolution and human, cultural, or technological change have done vastly more harm than good, and examples abound of this most common of intellectual traps. Biological evolution is powered by natural selection. Cultural evolution by a different set of principles that I understand but dimly. Stephen J. Gould, 1991A, page 63. Nobody wants to reinvent the wheel. A mythic example of wasted design work, and I have no intention of making that error here. Up till now, I have been helping myself to Dawkins' term, meme, as the name for any item of cultural evolution, postponing the discussion of what kind of Darwinian theory of memes we might be able to devise. the time has come to consider more carefully what Dawkins' memes are or might be. He has done much of the basic design work, drawing on the work of others, of course, and I myself have drawn on his meme before, devoting considerable time and effort to building suitable explanation vehicles out of it. I am going to reuse these earlier constructions, adding further design modifications. I first presented my own version, Dennett, 1990C, of Dawkins' account of memes in a Mandel lecture to the American Society for Aesthetics, a lecture series endowed for the purpose of exploring the question whether art promotes human evolution. The answer is yes. I then excepted my own device, reusing it with modifications in my book on human consciousness, 1991A, pages 199 to 208, to show how memes could transform the operating system or computational architecture of a human brain. That account offers many details about the relationship between the genetically designed hardware of the human brain and the culturally transmitted habits that transform it into something much more powerful, and I will skip lightly over most of those details here. This time I will modify my acceptation of Dawkins a second time, the better to deal with the particular environmental problems encountered in the current explanatory project. Those who are familiar with either of its immediate ancestors should find important improvements in the current version. The outlines of the theory of evolution by natural selection make clear that evolution occurs whenever the following conditions exist. 1. Variation. There is a continuing abundance of different elements. 2. Heredity or replication. The elements have the capacity to create copies or replicas of themselves. 3. Differential fitness. The number of copies of an element that are created in a given time varies, depending on interactions between the features of that element and features of the environment in which it persists. Notice that this definition, though drawn from biology, says nothing specific about organic molecules, nutrition, or even life. This maximally abstract definition of evolution by natural selection has been formulated in many roughly equivalent versions. See, for example, Lewontin 1980 and Brandon 1978, both reprinted in Sober 1984b. As Dawkins has pointed out, the fundamental principle is that all life evolves by the differential survival of replicating entities. The gene, the DNA molecule, happens to be the replicating entity which prevails on our planet. There may be others. If there are, provided certain other conditions are met, they will almost inevitably tend to become the basis for an evolutionary process. But do we have to go to distant worlds to find other kinds of replication and other consequent kinds of evolution? I think that a new kind of replicator has recently emerged on this very planet. It is staring us in the face. It is still in its infancy, still drifting clumsily about in its primeval soup. But already it is achieving evolutionary change at a rate which leaves the old gene panting far behind. Dawkins, 1976, page 206. These new replicators are, roughly, ideas. Not the simple ideas of Locke and Hume, the idea of red or the idea of round or hot or cold, but the sort of complex ideas that form themselves into distinct, memorable units, such as the ideas of arch, wheel, wearing clothes, vendetta, right triangle, alphabet, calendar, the Odyssey, calculus, chess, perspective drawing, evolution by natural selection, impressionism, greensleeves, deconstructionism. Intuitively, we see these as more or less identifiable cultural units, but we can say something more precise about how we draw the boundaries, about why D to F pound sign A isn't a unit, And the theme from the slow movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony is, the units are the smallest elements that replicate themselves with reliability and fecundity. We can compare them in this regard to genes and their components. CGA. A single codon of DNA is too small to be a gene. It is one of the codes for the amino acid arginine, and it copies itself prodigiously wherever it appears in genomes, but its effects are not individual enough to count as a gene. A three-nucleotide phrase does not count as a gene for the same reason that you can't copyright a three-note musical phrase. It is not enough to make a melody. But there is no principled lower limit on the length of a sequence that might come to be considered a gene or a meme. Dawkins, 1982, page 89 and the pages that follow it. The first four notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony are clearly a meme, replicating all by themselves, detached from the rest of the symphony, but keeping intact a certain identity of effect, a phenotypic effect, and hence thriving in context in which Beethoven and his works are unknown. Dawkins explains how he coined the name he gave these units. A unit of cultural transmission, or a unit of imitation. My meme comes from a suitable Greek root, but I want a monosyllable that sounds a bit like gene. It could alternatively be thought of as being related to memory, or to the French word, meme. Examples of memes are tunes, ideas, catchphrases, clothes fashions, ways of making pots or of building arches. Just as genes propagate themselves in the gene pool by leaping from body to body via sperm or eggs, so memes propagate themselves in the meme pool by leaping from brain to brain via a process which, in the broad sense, can be called imitation. If a scientist hears or reads about a good idea, he passes it on to his colleagues and students. He mentions it in his articles and his lectures. If the idea catches on, it can be said to propagate itself, spreading from brain to brain. Dawkins, 1976, page 206. Meme evolution is not just analogous to biological or genic evolution, according to Dawkins. It is not just a process that can be metaphorically described in these evolutionary idioms, but a phenomenon that obeys the laws of natural selection quite exactly. The theory of evolution by natural selection is neutral, he suggests, regarding the differences between memes and genes. These are just different kinds of replicators evolving in different media at different rates. And just as the genes for animals could not come into existence on this planet until the evolution of plants had paved the way, creating the oxygen-rich atmosphere and ready supply of convertible nutrients, so the evolution of memes could not get started until the evolution of animals had paved the way by creating a species, Homo sapiens, with brains that could provide shelter, and habits of communication that could provide transmission media for memes. There is no denying that there is cultural evolution, in the Darwin-neutral sense that cultures change over time, accumulating and losing features while also maintaining features from earlier ages. The history of the idea of, say, crucifixion, or of a dome on squinches, or powered flight, is undeniably a history of transmission through various non-genetic media of a family of variations on a central theme. But whether such evolution is weakly or strongly analogous to or parallel to genetic evolution, the process that Darwinian theory explains so well is an open question. In fact, it is many open questions. At one extreme, we may imagine it could turn out that cultural evolution recapitulates all the features of genetic evolution. Not only are there gene analogs, memes, but there are strict analogs of phenotypes, genotypes, sexual reproduction, sexual selection, DNA, RNA, codons, allopatric speciation, DEEMs, genomic imprinting, and so forth. The whole edifice of biological theory perfectly mirrored in the medium of culture. You thought DNA splicing was a scary technology? Wait till they start making meme implants in their laboratories. Not likely. At the other extreme, cultural evolution could be discovered to operate according to entirely different principles, as Gould suggests, so that there was no help at all to be found amid the concepts of biology. This is surely what many humanists and social scientists fervently hope, but it is also highly unlikely, for reasons we have already noted. In between the extremes lie the likely and valuable prospects that there is a large, or large-ish, and important, or merely mildly interesting, transfer of concepts from biology to the human sciences. It might be, for example, that although the processes of cultural transmission of ideas are truly Darwinian phenomena, for various reasons they resist being captured in a Darwinian science. So we will have to settle for the merely philosophical realizations that we can glean from this, and leave science to tackle other projects. First, let's consider the case for the claim that the phenomena of cultural evolution are truly Darwinian. Then we can turn to the skeptical complications. At the outset, the meme perspective is distinctly unsettling, even appalling. We can sum it up with a slogan. A scholar is just a library's way of making another library. I don't know about you, but I am not initially attracted by the idea of my brain as a sort of dung heap in which the larvae of other people's ideas renew themselves before sending out copies of themselves in an informational diaspora. It does seem to rob my mind of its importance as both author and critic. Who's in charge according to this vision? We or our memes? There is no simple answer to that important question. There could not be. We would like to think of ourselves as godlike creators of ideas, manipulating and controlling them as our whim dictates, and judging them from an independent Olympian standpoint. But even if this is our ideal, we know that it is seldom, if ever, the reality, even with the most masterful and creative minds. As Mozart famously observed of his own brain children, "When I feel well and in a good humor, or when I am taking a drive or walking after a good meal, or in the night when I cannot sleep, thoughts crowd into my mind as easily as you would wish. Whence and how do they come? I do not know, and I have nothing to do with it. Those which please me I keep in my head and hum them. At least others have told me that I do so." Mozart is in good company. Rare is the novelist who doesn't claim characters who take on a life of their own. Artists are rather fond of confessing that their paintings take over and paint themselves, and poets humbly submit that they are the servants or even slaves to the ideas that teem in their heads, not the bosses. And we all can cite cases of memes that persist unbidden and unappreciated in our own minds, or that spread like rumors, in spite of the general disapproval of that spreading by those who help spread them. The other day, I was embarrassed, dismayed to catch myself walking along, humming a melody to myself. It was not a theme of Haydn or Brahms or Charlie Parker or even Bob Dylan. I was energetically humming "It Takes Two to Tango," a perfectly dismal and entirely unredeemed bit of chewing gum for the ears that was unaccountably popular sometime in the 1950s. I am sure I have never in my life chosen this melody, esteemed this melody, or in any way judged it to be better than silence. But there it was, a horrible musical virus, at least as robust in my meme pool as any melody I actually esteem. And now, to make matters worse, I have resurrected the virus in many of you, who will no doubt curse me in days to come when you find yourself humming, for the first time in over 30 years, that boring tune. Human language, first spoken and then very recently written, is surely the principal medium of cultural transmission, creating the infosphere in which cultural evolution occurs. Speaking and hearing, writing and reading, these are the underlying technologies of transmission and replication most analogous to the technologies of DNA and RNA in the biosphere. I needn't bother reviewing the familiar facts about the recent explosive proliferation of these media via the memes for movable type, radio and television, xerography, computers, fax machines, and electronic mail. We are all well aware that today we live awash in a sea of paper-borne memes, breathing in an atmosphere of electronically born memes. Memes now spread around the world at the speed of light and replicate at rates that make even fruit flies and yeast cells look glacial in comparison. They leap promiscuously from vehicle to vehicle and from medium to medium and are proving to be virtually unquarantinable. Genes are invisible. They are carried by gene vehicles, organisms, in which they tend to produce characteristic effects, phenotypic effects, by which their fates are, in the long run, determined. Memes are also invisible, and are carried by meme vehicles, pictures, books, sayings, in particular languages, oral or written, on paper or magnetically encoded, etc. Tools and buildings and other innovations are also meme vehicles. Campbell, 1979. A wagon with spoked wheels carries not only grain or freight from place to place, it carries the brilliant idea of a wagon with spoked wheels from mind to mind. A meme's existence depends on a physical embodiment in some medium. If all such physical embodiments are destroyed, that meme is extinguished. It may, of course, make a subsequent, independent reappearance, just as dinosaur genes could, in principle, get together again in some distant future. But the dinosaurs they created and inhabited would not be descendants of the original dinosaurs, or at least not any more directly than we are. The fate of memes is similarly determined by whether copies and copies of them persist and multiply, and this depends on the selective forces that act directly on the various physical vehicles that embody them. Memes, like genes, are potentially immortal, but like genes, they depend on the existence of a continuous chain of physical vehicles, persisting in the face of the second law of thermodynamics. Books are relatively permanent, and inscriptions on monuments even more permanent. But unless these are under the protection of human conservators, they tend to dissolve in time. Manfred Eigen makes the same point about genes, though driving the analogy in the other direction. Consider, for instance, one of Mozart's compositions, one that is retained stably in our concert repertoire. The reason for its retention is not that the notes of this work are printed in a particularly durable ink. The persistence with which Mozart's symphony reappears in our concert programs is solely a consequence of its high selection value. In order for this to retain its effect, the work must be played again and again. The public must take note of it, and it must be continually reevaluated in competition with other compositions. Stability of genetic information has similar causes. Eigen, 1992, page 15. As with genes, immortality is more a matter of replication than of the longevity of individual vehicles. As we noted in Chapter 6, the preservation of the Platonic memes via a series of copies of copies is a particularly striking case of this. Although a few papyrus fragments of Plato's texts, roughly contemporaneous with the man himself, still exist, The survival of his memes owes almost nothing to the chemical stability of these fragments. Today's libraries contain thousands, if not millions, of physical copies and translations of Plato's Republic, and the key ancestors in the transmission of this text turned to dust centuries ago. Brute physical replication of vehicles is not enough to ensure meme longevity. A few thousand hard-bound copies of a new book can disappear with scarcely a trace in a few years, and who knows how many brilliant letters to the editor, reproduced in hundreds of thousands of copies, disappear into landfills and incinerators every day. The day may come when non-human meme evaluators suffice to select and arrange for the preservation of particular memes, but for the time being, memes still depend at least indirectly on one or more of their vehicles spending at least a brief pupil stage in a remarkable sort of meme nest, a human mind. Minds are in limited supply, and each mind has a limited capacity for memes, and hence there is a considerable competition among memes for entry into as many minds as possible. This competition is the major selective force in the infosphere, and, just as in the biosphere, the challenge has been met with great ingenuity. Whose ingenuity, you may want to ask? But by now you should know that this is not always a good question. The ingenuity is there to appreciate, whatever its source. Like a mindless virus, a meme's prospects depend on its design. Not its internal design, whatever that might be, but the design it shows the world, its phenotype, the way it affects things in its environment. The things in its environment are minds and other memes. For instance, whatever virtues, from our perspective, the following memes have, they have in common the property of having phenotypic expressions that tend to make their own replication more likely by disabling or preempting the environmental forces that would tend to extinguish them. The meme for faith, which discourages the exercise of the sort of critical judgment that might decide that the idea of faith was, all things considered, a dangerous idea. Dawkins, 1976, page 212. The memes for tolerance or free speech. The meme for including a warning in a chain letter about the terrible fates of those who have broken the chain in the past. The conspiracy theory meme, which has a built-in response to the objection that there is no good evidence of the conspiracy. Of course not. That's how powerful the conspiracy is. Some of these memes are good, and others bad. What they have in common is a phenotypic effect that systematically tends to disable the selective forces arrayed against them. Other things being equal, memetics predicts that conspiracy theory memes will persist quite independently of their truth, and the meme for faith is apt to secure its own survival, and that of the religious memes that ride piggyback on it, in even the most rationalistic environments. Indeed, the meme for faith exhibits frequency to dependency fitness. It flourishes particularly in the company of rationalistic memes. In a skeptic poor world, the meme for faith does not attract much attention, and hence tends to go dormant in minds, and hence is seldom reintroduced into the infosphere. Can we demonstrate classic predator-to-prey population boom-and-bust cycles between memes for faith and memes for reason? Probably not. But it might be instructive to look, and ask why not. Other concepts from population genetics transfer quite smoothly. Here is a case of what a geneticist would call linked loci. Two memes that happen to be physically tied together so that they tend always to replicate together, a tendency that affects their chances. There is a magnificent ceremonial march, familiar to many of us and generally beloved. It is stirring and bright and grand, just the thing you would think to use for commencements, weddings, and other festive occasions. perhaps driving pomp and circumstance and the wedding march from Lohengrin to near extinction, were it not for the fact that its musical meme is too tightly linked to its title meme, which we all tend to think of as soon as we hear the music. Sir Arthur Sullivan's unusable masterpiece, Behold the Lord High Executioner. If this march had no lyrics and were titled, say, Coco's March, it would not be disqualified from use. But the actual title, comprising the first five words of the lyrics, which are tightly locked to the melody, virtually guarantees a chain of thought in most listeners that would be undesirable on almost any festive occasion. This is the phenotypic effect that prevents the greater replication of this meme. If performances of the Mikado waned over the years, so that a time came when few, if any, people knew the lyrics of the march, let alone the silly story, the march might come back into its own as a piece of ceremonial music without words, except for the darn title at the head of the score. It wouldn't look good on the program, would it, just before the vice chancellor's address to the graduates? This is actually just a vivid case of one of the most important phenomena in the infosphere, the misfiltering of memes due to such linkages. There is even a meme that names the phenomenon, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. This audiobook is largely intended to undo the unfortunate effects of misfiltering the Darwinian memes, a process that has been going on ever since Darwin himself got confused about which were his best ideas, even though some of his enemies agreed with them, and which were his worst, even though they seemed to perform yeoman service against certain pernicious doctrines. R. Richards, 1987, provides a particularly fascinating history of the evolution of the ideas of evolution. We all have filters of the following sort. Ignore everything that appears in X. For some people, X is the National Geographic or Pravda. For others, it is the New York Review of Books. We all take our chances, counting on the good ideas to make it eventually through the stacks of filters of others into the limelight of our attention. This structure of filters is itself a meme construction of considerable robustness. John McCarthy, one of the founders of artificial intelligence and the coiner of its name, a meme with its own independent base in the infosphere, once suggested to a humanist audience that electronic mail networks could revolutionize the ecology of the poet. Only a handful of poets can make their living by selling their poems, McCarthy noted, because poetry books are slender, expensive volumes purchased by very few individuals and libraries. But imagine what would happen if poets could put their poems on an international network where anybody could read them or copy them for a penny, electronically transferred to the poet's royalty account. This could provide a steady source of income for many poets, he surmised. Quite independently of any aesthetic objections poets and poetry lovers might have to poems embodied in electronic media, the obvious counter-hypothesis arises from population mimetics. If such a network were established, no poetry lover would be willing to wade through thousands of electronic files filled with doggerel, looking for the good poems. There would be a niche created for various memes for poetry filters. One could subscribe for a few pennies to an editorial service that scanned the infosphere for good poems. Different services, with different critical standards, would flourish, as would services for reviewing all the different services, and services that screened, collected, formatted, and presented the works of the best poets in slender electronic volumes, which only a few would purchase. In other words, the memes for editing and criticism will find niches in any environment in the infosphere. They flourish because of the short supply and limited capacity of minds, whatever the transmission media between minds. Do you doubt this prediction? If so, I'd like to discuss framing a suitable wager with you. Here, once again, as we have seen so often in evolutionary thinking, explanation proceeds by an assumption that the processes, whatever their media, and whatever the contingent zigs and zags of their particular trajectories, will home in on the forced moves and other good tricks in the relevant space. The structure of filters is complex and quick to respond to new challenges, but of course it doesn't always work. The competition among memes to break through the filters leads to an arms race of ploy and counterploy, with ever more elaborate advertising raised against ever more layers of selective filters. In the dignified ecology of academia, we don't call it advertising. But the same arms race is manifested in department letterheads, blind refereeing, the proliferation of specialized journals, book reviews, reviews of book reviews, and anthologies of classic works. These filters are not even always intended to preserve the best. Philosophers might care to ask themselves, for instance, how often they are accomplices in increasing the audience for a second-rate article simply because their introductory course needs a simple-minded version of a bad idea that even the freshman can refute. Some of the most frequently reprinted articles in 20th century philosophy are famous precisely because nobody believes them. Everybody can see what is wrong with them. A related phenomenon in the competition of memes for our attention is positive feedback. In biology, this is manifested in such phenomena as the runaway sexual selection that explains the long and cumbersome tail of the bird of paradise or the peacock. For the details, see Dawkins, 1986A, pages 195 to 220, Cronin, 1991, Matt Ridley, 1993. Dawkins, 1986A, page 219, provides an example from the world of publishing. Bestseller lists of books are published weekly, and it is undoubtedly true that as soon as a book sells enough copies to appear in one of these lists, its sales increase even more, simply by virtue of that fact. Publishers speak of a book taking off, and those publishers with some knowledge of science even speak of a critical mass for takeoff. Meme vehicles inhabit our world alongside all the fauna and flora, large and small. By and large, they are visible only to the human species, however. Consider the environment of the average New York City pigeon, whose eyes and ears are assaulted every day by approximately as many words, pictures, and other signs and symbols as assault each human New Yorker. These physical meme vehicles may impinge importantly on the pigeon's welfare, but not by virtue of the memes they carry. It means nothing to the pigeon that it is under a page of the National Enquirer, not the New York Times, that it finds a crumb. To human beings, on the other hand, each meme vehicle is a potential friend or foe, bearing a gift that will enhance our powers or a gift horse that will distract us, burden our memories, derange our judgment. 3. Could there be a science of memetics? The scope of the understanding strikes me as staggering. But more than this, if one accepts the evolutionary perspective, attempts to discuss science, or any other sort of conceptual activity, become much more difficult, so difficult as to produce total paralysis. David Hull, 1982, page 299. Memes are capable of instructing not protein synthesis as genes do, but behavior. However, genes can do that too, indirectly, through protein synthesis. On the other hand, meme replication, by involving neurostructural modifications, is invariably associated with the induction of protein synthesis. Juan Delius, 1991, page 84. This is all very enticing, but we have been glossing over a host of complications. I can hear a chorus of skepticism building in the wings. Remember the story near the end of chapter 4 about Francis Crick's jaundiced view of population genetics as science? If population genetics just barely qualifies as science, and obsolete science at that, what chance is there for a true science of memetics? Philosophers, some will say, may appreciate the apparent insight to be found in a striking new perspective, but if you can't turn it into actual science, with testable hypotheses, reliable formalizations, and quantifiable results, what good is it, really? Dawkins himself has never claimed to be founding a new scientific discipline of memetics. Is this because there is something wrong with the concept of a meme? What stands to a meme as DNA stands to a gene? Several commentators, for example, Delius, 1991, have argued for the identification of memes with complex brain structures, parallel to the identification of genes with complex structures of DNA. But as we have already noted, it is a mistake to identify genes with their vehicles in DNA. The idea that evolution is an algorithmic process is the idea that it must have a useful description in substrate-neutral terms. As George Williams proposed many years ago, 1966, page 25, in evolutionary theory, a gene could be defined as any hereditary information for which there is favorable or unfavorable selection bias equal to several or many times its rate of endogenous change. The importance of the separation between information and vehicle is even easier to discern in the case of memes. The obvious problem noted by all is that it is very unlikely, but not quite impossible, that there is a uniform brain language in which information is stored in different human brains, and this makes brains very different from chromosomes. Geneticists have recently identified a chromosomal structure they call the homeobox. In spite of differences, this structure is identifiable in widely separated species of animals, perhaps in them all. So it is very ancient, and it plays a central role in embryological development. We may be startled at first to learn that a gene identified as playing a major role in eye development in the homeobox of mice has almost the same codon spelling as a gene dubbed, for its phenotypic effect, eyeless, when it was identified in the homeobox of the fruit fly, Drosophila. But we would be even more flabbergasted were we to discover that the brain cell complex that stored the original meme for bifocals in Benjamin Franklin's brain was the same as, or very similar to, the brain cell complex that is called upon today to store the meme for bifocals whenever any child in Asia, Africa, or Europe first learns about them. By reading about them, seeing them on television, or noticing them on a parent's nose. What this reflection makes vivid is the fact that what is preserved and transmitted in cultural evolution is information, in a media-neutral, language-neutral sense. Thus, the meme is primarily a semantic classification, not a syntactic classification that might be directly observable in brain language or natural language. In the case of genes, we are blessed by a gratifyingly strong alignment of semantic and syntactic identity. There is a single genetic language in which meaning is roughly preserved across all species. Still, it is important to distinguish semantic types from syntactic types. In the Library of Babel, we identify a set of syntactic text variants as all falling into the Moby Dick galaxy by virtue of what they tell us about, not their syntactic similarity. Think of all the different translations of Moby Dick into other languages, and also the English abridgments, outlines, and study aids, to say nothing of the versions in film and other media. Our interest in identifying and re-identifying genes over the evolutionary ages is similarly primarily because of the uniformity of the phenotypic effects, what they are about, such as making hemoglobin or eyes. Our ability to rely on their syntactic identifiability in DNA is a recent advance, and even when we cannot conceivably avail ourselves of it, for instance, in deducing facts about genetic changes from what we can observe in the fossil record of species that have left no DNA for us to read. We can still confidently speak of the genes, the information, that must have been preserved or transmitted. It is conceivable, but hardly likely, and certainly not necessary, that we will someday discover a striking identity between brain structures storing the same information, allowing us to identify memes syntactically. Even if we encountered such an unlikely blessing, however, we should cling to the more abstract and fundamental concept of memes, since we already know that meme transmission and storage can proceed indefinitely in non-cerebral forms, in artifacts of every kind, that do not depend on a shared language of description. If ever there was multimedia transmission and transformation of information, it is cultural transmission and transformation. So some of the varieties of reductionistic triumph we have come to expect in biology, discovering exactly how many different ways hemoglobin is spelled in all the species in the world, for instance, are almost certainly ruled out in any science of culture, notwithstanding the prophecies of a golden age of mind reading one sometimes hears these days from the ideologues of neuroscience. This would thwart only some kinds of mimetic science. But isn't the situation actually worse than that? Darwinian evolution, as we have discussed, depends on very high-fidelity copying. Almost, but not quite perfect copying, thanks to the exquisite proofreading and duplication machinery of the DNA readers that accompany the DNA texts. Raise the mutation rate just a bit too high, and evolution goes haywire. Natural selection can no longer work to guarantee fitness over the long run. Minds, or brains, on the other hand, aren't much like photocopying machines at all. On the contrary, instead of just dutifully passing on their messages, correcting most of the typos as they go, brains seem to be designed to do just the opposite, to transform, invent, interpolate, censor, and generally mix up the input before yielding any output. Isn't one of the hallmarks of cultural evolution and transmission the extraordinarily high rate of mutation and recombination? We seldom pass on a meme unaltered, it seems, unless we are particularly literal-minded rote learners. Are walking encyclopedias hidebound? Moreover, as Steven Pinker has stressed, through personal communication, much of the mutation that happens to memes, how much is not clear, is manifestly directed mutation. Memes, such as the theory of relativity, are not the cumulative product of millions of random, undirected mutations of some original idea. But each brain in the chain of production added huge dollops of value to the product in a non-random way. Indeed, the whole power of minds as meme nests comes from what a biologist would call lineage crossing, or anastomosis, the coming back together of separating gene pools. As Gould, 1991A, page 65, points out, the basic topologies of biological and cultural change are completely different. Biological evolution is a system of constant divergence without subsequent joining of branches. Lineages, once distinct, are separate forever. In human history, transmission across lineages is, perhaps, the major source of cultural change. Moreover, when memes come into contact with each other in a mind, they have a marvelous capacity to become adjusted to each other, swiftly changing their phenotypic effects to fit the circumstances. And it is the recipe for the new phenotype that then gets replicated when the mind broadcasts or publishes the results of this mixing. For instance, my 3-year-old grandson, who loves construction machinery, recently blurted out a fine mutation on a nursery rhyme, "Pop Goes the Diesel." He didn't even notice what he had done, but I, to whom the phrase would never have occurred, have now seen to it that this mutant meme gets replicated. As in the case of jokes discussed earlier, this modest moment of creativity is a mixture of serendipity and appreciation, distributed over several minds, no one of which gets to claim the authorship of special creation. It is a sort of Lamarckian replication of acquired characteristics, as Gould and others have suggested. The very creativity and activity of human minds as temporary homes for memes seems to guarantee that lines of descent are hopelessly muddled, and that phenotypes, the body designs of memes, change so fast that there's no keeping track of the natural kinds. Recall from chapter 10 that species are invisible without a modicum of stasis. But remember, too, that this is an epistemological, not a metaphysical point. If species weren't rather static, we couldn't find out and organize the facts needed to do certain kinds of science. That wouldn't show, however, that the phenomena weren't governed by natural selection. Similarly, the conclusion here would be a pessimistic epistemological conclusion. Even if memes do originate by a process of descent with modification, our chances of cranking out a science that charts that descent are slim. Once the worry is put in that form, it points to what may seem to be a partial solution. One of the most striking features of cultural evolution is the ease, reliability, and confidence with which we can identify commonalities, in spite of the vast differences in underlying media. What do Romeo and Juliet and the film, let's say, of West Side Story have in common? Dennett, 1987b. Not a string of English characters, not even a sequence of propositions in English or French or German translation. What is in common, of course, is not a syntactic property or system of properties, but a semantic property or system of properties. The story, not the text. The characters and their personalities, not their names and speeches. What we so readily identify as the same thing in both cases is the predicament that both William Shakespeare and Arthur Lorentz, who wrote the book for West Side Story, want us to think about. So it is only at the level of intentional objects, once we have adopted the intentional stance, that we can describe these common properties. When we do adopt the stance, the sought-for common features often stick out like sore thumbs. Does this help? Yes, but we must be careful about a problem we have already identified in several different guises, the problem of how to tell plagiarism, or respectful borrowing, from convergent evolution. As Hull, 1982, page 300, points out, we do not want to consider two identical cultural items as instances of the same meme unless they are related by descent. The genes for octopus eyes are not the same genes as those for dolphin eyes, however similar the eyes may appear. This is apt to create a host of illusions, or just undecidability, for cultural evolutionists whenever they attempt to trace the memes for good tricks. The more abstract the level at which we identify the memes, the harder it is to tell convergent evolution from descent. We happen to know, because they told us, that the creators of West Side Story, Arthur Lorentz, Jerome Robbins, and Leonard Bernstein, got the idea from Romeo and Juliet. But if they had been carefully secretive about this, we might well have thought they had simply reinvented a wheel, rediscovered a cultural universal that will appear on its own in almost any cultural evolution. The more purely semantic our principles of identification are, or in other words, the less bound they are to particular forms of expression, the harder it is to trace descent with confidence. Remember that it was peculiarities in the particular form of expression that gave Otto Neugebauer his crucial clue in deciphering the mystery of the Greek translation of the Babylonian Ephemeris in Chapter 6. This is the same epistemological problem in the science of culture, that taxonomists confront when they try to sort out homology from analogy, ancestral from derived characters in cladistic analysis. Mark Ridley, 1985. Ideally, in the imagined field of cultural cladistics, one would want to find characters, literally, alphabetic characters, that are functionally optional choices within a huge class of possible alternatives. If we found whole speeches by Tony and Maria that suspiciously replicated the words and phrases of Romeo and Juliet, we wouldn't need autobiographical clues from Lorenz, Robbins, or Bernstein. We wouldn't hesitate to declare that the coincidence of the words was no coincidence. Design space is too vast to make that credible. In general, however, we can't count on such discoveries in our attempts at a science of cultural evolution. Suppose, for instance, we want to argue that such institutions as agriculture or monarchy, or even such particular practices as tattooing or shaking hands, descend from a common cultural ancestor instead of having been independently reinvented. There is a trade-off. To the extent that we have to go to quite abstract functional or semantic levels to find our common features, we lose the capacity to tell homology from analogy, descent from convergent evolution. This has always been tacitly appreciated by students of culture, of course, quite independently of Darwinian thinking. Consider what you can deduce from potsherds, for instance. Anthropologists looking for evidence of shared culture are, quite properly, more impressed by common idiosyncrasies of decorative style than by common functional shapes. Or consider the fact that two widely separated cultures both used boats. This is no evidence at all of a shared cultural heritage. If both cultures were to paint eyes on the bows of their boats, it would be much more interesting, but still a rather obvious move in the game of design. If both cultures were to paint, say, blue hexagons on the bows of their boats, this would be telling indeed. The anthropologist Dan Sperber, who has thought a great deal about cultural evolution, thinks there is a problem with any use of abstract, intentional objects as the anchors for a scientific project. Such abstract objects, he claims, do not directly enter into causal relations. What caused your indigestion was not the Mornay sauce recipe in the abstract, but your host having read a public representation, having formed a mental representation, and having followed it with greater or lesser success. What caused the child's enjoyable fear was not the story of Little Red Riding Hood in the abstract, but her understanding of her mother's words. More to the present point, what caused the Mornay sauce recipe or the story of Little Red Riding Hood to become cultural representations is not, or rather is not directly their formal properties. It is the construction of millions of mental representations causally linked by millions of public representations. Sperber, 1985, pages 77 to 78. What Sperber says about the indirectness of the role of the abstract features is certainly true, but, far from this being an obstacle to science, it is the best sort of invitation to science, an invitation to cut through the Gordian knot of tangled causation with an abstract formulation that is predictive precisely because it ignores all those complications. For instance, genes are selected because of their indirect and only statistically visible phenotypic effects. Consider the following prediction. Wherever you find moths with camouflage on their wings, you will find that they have keen-sighted predators. And wherever you find moths that are heavily predated by echolocating bats, you will find that they have traded in wing camouflage for jamming devices or a particular talent for creating evasive flight patterns. Of course, our ultimate goal is to explain whatever features we find in the moths and their surroundings all the way down to the molecular or atomic mechanisms responsible. But there is no reason to demand that such a reduction be uniform or generalizable across the board. It is the glory of science that it can find the patterns in spite of the noise. Dennett, 1991b. The peculiarities of human psychology, and human digestion for that matter, as the Mornay sauce example shows, are important eventually, but they don't stand in the way of a scientific analysis of the phenomenon in question. In fact, as Sperber himself has persuasively argued, we can use higher-level principles as levers to pry open lower-level secrets. Sperber points to the importance of the invention of writing, which initiated major changes in cultural evolution. He shows how to reason from facts about pre-literate culture to facts about human psychology. He prefers to think of cultural transmission along the lines of epidemiology rather than genetics, but the direction of his theory is very much the same as Dawkins, to the point of near indistinguishability when you think of what the Darwinian treatment of epidemiology looks like. See Williams and Ness, 1991. Here is Sperber's law of the epidemiology of representations. In an oral tradition, all cultural representations are easily remembered ones. Hard-to-remember representations are forgotten, or transformed into more easily remembered ones, before reaching a cultural level of distribution. Sperber, 1985, page 86. It looks trivial at first, but consider how we can apply it. We can use the existence of a particular sort of cultural representation endemic to oral traditions to shed light on how human memory works by asking what it is about this sort of representation that makes it more memorable than others. Sperber points out that people are better at remembering a story than they are at remembering a text, at least today, now that the oral tradition is waning. But even today, we sometimes remember, involuntarily, an advertising jingle, including its precise rhythmic properties, its tone of voice, and many other low-level features. When scientists decide on acronyms or cute slogans for their theories, they are hoping thereby to make them more memorable, more vivid and attractive memes. And hence, the actual details of the representing are sometimes just as much a candidate for memehood as the content represented. Using acronyms is itself a meme, a meta-meme, of course, which caught on because of its demonstrated power in furthering the content memes whose name memes it helped to design. What is it about acronyms?